Well, thank you, Mr. Hawk. Well, last time, brethren, I had a chance to speak with you. We talked about the miracles of Elisha. We began by discussing how we believe things that are physically impossible. In fact, the very definition of miracle is something that is not explicable by natural or scientific laws, and is therefore considered to be the work of a divine agency. We talked about miracles and what we might learn from them. Well, we only got about halfway through the story of Elisha. So we're going to continue today with what we might be able to learn from the miracles God did through Elisha to see what else we might add to our list. Now, I apologize to those who did not have a chance to hear part one, but I assure you that part two is understandable without part one. It's not a continuation in the sense of you must build on top of the first set of lessons. There's many other lessons that we might learn. What I'd like to do is go back with you all to the beginning of Elisha's ministry, we might say. Let's take a look at 2 Kings chapter 2. We actually didn't cover this one last time, so I thought it might be helpful to go back after we have some of the information that we already have, to take a look at the actual first miracle, we might say, that was done through Elisha. 2 Kings chapter 2, beginning in verse 6. Now, you remember what had happened. Elisha was the servant of Elijah. And Elijah, his time had come to pass the baton, we might say, for the next generation to take over. Elijah says to Elisha in verse 6, "Stay here, please, for the Eternal has sent me on to the Jordan." But he said, Elisha said, "As the Lord lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you." So the two of them went on. It strikes you a little bit like the statement that Ruth made to Naomi when she said, "I will never leave you or forsake you. I'm going to follow you. Wherever you go, your God's going to be my God. I'm going to follow you." So Elisha is going to follow Elijah. Wanted to be with him, serve him faithfully from that time forward. So verse 7, 50 men of the sons of the prophets went and stood facing them at a distance while the two of them stood by the Jordan. So there are 50 eyewitnesses to this event. Now Elijah took his mantle, this outer cloak, this robe that he wore. He took his mantle, rolled it up, and struck the water, and it was divided this way and that, so the two of them crossed over on dry ground. So pretty amazing miracle. Like the parting of the Red Sea. In this case, it was the parting of the Jordan River. They walked over on dry ground. So not only did the water stop flowing down, but a pathway was opened up. The ground is immediately dried, and they walk over without even getting muddy. Verse 9, "And it was so when they'd crossed over that Elijah said to Elisha, 'Ask what I may do for you before I'm taken away from you.'" So Elijah knew he would be taken away. "And Elisha said, 'Please let a double portion of your spirit be upon me.'" So we've talked before about the power and authority of Elijah would then descend upon or be given to, we might say, Elisha. In verse 10, "So he said, 'You've asked a hard thing. Nevertheless, if you see me when I am taken from you, it shall be so for you. But if not, it shall not be so.'" So he must faithfully follow until that time. Then it happened, as they continued on and talked, that suddenly a chariot of fire appeared with horses of fire and separated the two of them. And Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. Now, there's a couple assumptions here that it's worthwhile to take a moment possibly to at least discuss. This is where, of course, the spiritual swing low, sweet chariot comes from. Now, there's several assumptions here. One assumption is that Elijah got in the chariot. Does it ever say that Elijah actually was in the chariot? And the answer is no, it doesn't say that. It says he was taken up by a whirlwind. The second assumption that people often make with this is that this chariot took Elijah directly to heaven. directly, in other words, to his final reward, living in heaven with God, with Christ, with the Holy Spirit as they would look at it. And is that true? Is that what this scripture says? No, it says they went up by a whirlwind into heaven. Where is a whirlwind effective? In our atmosphere. To go beyond the atmosphere, there is no such thing as a whirlwind like this. A tornado up in space? I don't think so. So the assumption simply is not true that Elijah rode the chariot necessarily. Now, he might have, but it doesn't say that. It's only an assumption that could be made. And certainly he did not go into the third heaven where God himself lives. We'll find out later on, of course, as you know, that Elijah later on writes a letter to the king of Israel. Obviously, he was still on the earth. So he was picked up, separated. In other words, he was officially retired at this moment. Now, wouldn't it be great if all of us got a chariot ride of fire when it was time to retire? Most of us just drop over dead and we're retired. But in this case, Elijah was picked up, set down someplace else, and now the responsibility transfers to Elisha. So the first miracle of Elisha now comes about. Verse 12, Elisha saw it and cried out, "My father, my father, the chariot of Israel and its horsemen." Now we ask, why did God send this chariot and its horsemen? So again, it seems to be, if there are horsemen, that means someone is driving the chariot. So we have these angelic beings, these angelic horses of some sort, an angelic transport of some sort, and angelic beings that are driving this thing. It's a fascinating miracle. So he saw it. Now, why did God send that at that particular time? I don't know. I don't have a good explanation for that, other than maybe God was simply showing just how powerful he is and how much he was supporting the work that Elijah had been doing. So he cries out. So he saw him no more. Verse 12. And he took hold of his own clothes and tore them in two pieces. That was a symbol of mourning, knowing that Elijah now was gone from the scene. Verse 13, he took up the mantle of Elijah that had fallen from him and went back and stood by the bank of the Jordan. Elisha didn't mourn and cry and weep because he knew what God was up to. He knew that now the transfer of authority needed to take place. So he marches back to the Jordan. And then in verse 14, he took the mantle of Elijah that had fallen from him and struck the water and said, "Where is the eternal God of Elijah?" And when he also had struck the water, it was divided this way and that, and Elijah crossed over. Now we wonder with the translation, did he actually ask, "Where is the God of Elijah?" Was he making a statement in that sense? It was clear in Elisha's mind that he now was given, as we call it, the mantle of authority that Elijah had previously. So this symbol of power and authority was something that was very clearly now given to Elisha. And he used this mantle to simply split open the Jordan River again. Now, let's look at the lesson that we might learn from this. Verse 15. Now, when the sons of the prophets who were from Jericho saw him, they said, "The spirit of Elijah rests on Elisha." And they came to meet him and bowed to the ground before him. What I gather from this particular miracle is God's people must discern where God is working. I remember many years ago when I was a very young minister that I was taught to teach God's people the law of tithing. But I was also taught to teach them that we don't want your money. It's not why we teach tithing. We don't say, "Well, we really need money, so you need to tithe so that we get money." Mr. Armstrong never said that. He always knew that you don't ask for money. You teach tithing, but you don't ask for money. And his point was, as he would go on to explain it, is that you must tithe. That's God's law. Now, if you don't know where God's money should go, it's His tithe. You stick it in a sock, you put it under your mattress, you put it under your pillow, you put it in the bank, you hang on to it until you discern where God is working. And then that's where God's tithe should go. So He never begged for money in that kind of sense or asked for money. Yes, tithing is a law, but God's people must discern where God is working, and then that's where God's tithe should go. In this case, the sons of the prophets had to discern where the spirit and power of Elijah had gone. And it clearly went to Elisha, and as a result, they came and bowed down on the ground before him. And of course, they wanted to go look for Elijah to make sure he would just not drop somewhere. They were going to give him a proper burial, they thought. Well, no, they couldn't find him, as you probably remember from the story. But it's important for God's people, a lesson we take from this mantle, is that God's people must discern where God is working. And then they faithfully support that work with God's tithe. It's not their tithe, it's not the church's tithe, it's God's tithe. So these 50 sons of the prophets likewise came before Elisha and said, "You're the guy in charge. We yield in that sense." Now, if you turn back to 1 Kings 19, it is important to remember that this was a process. And we'll tie this aspect of the story in a little bit later on today. 1 Kings chapter 19 and verse 15 and 16. This was not the first time that Elisha wore the mantle of Elijah. And that may be a part of the story we don't recall as quickly. 2 Kings chapter, I'm sorry, 1 Kings 19 in verse 15. The story, as you recall here, as we mentioned last time, Elijah stood up for the true God. And he had that excellent face-off, we might say, with the prophets of Baal over here and Elijah by himself over here. And Elijah ends up praying and God sends fire from heaven. It consumes the sacrifice. It evaporates the water. It vaporizes the altar itself. And it's clear who the true God is. And so he says, if this is the true God, Israel, you should get rid of the prophets of Baal. So they murder, they kill, they execute, rightly so, all 450 prophets of Baal. Well, who's left? Well, the employer, or the employeress, Jezebel, who was the one who was supporting these 450 prophets of Baal. Now she is it proper to say ticked off? She's angry. She is upset. And she is out for the life of Elijah. He flees, of course, and he ends up in this cave. And God realizes, you know, it's time for Elijah to retire. It's time. He's done his job, and he's done it well. We put him through a lot. So God allows, in that sense, Elijah now a chance to take it easy, to resign, in that sense, to retire. So in 1 Kings 19, beginning in verse 15, the Eternal said to him, this is to Elijah, I mean, after all this, go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. Got a couple more jobs for you to do before you get the gold watch and the retirement, or in this case, the chariots of fire and the horsemen. When you arrive, anoint Hazael as king over Syria. Also, verse 16, you shall anoint Jehu, the son of Nimshi, as king over Israel. And, note this, Elisha, the son of Shaphat, and Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint as prophet in your place. So it was not a surprise later on when Elisha is chosen to replace Elijah. God set this up in advance. If you drop down to verse 19, so he departed from there and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen before him. I can only assume from that Elisha was a fairly wealthy individual, because he had 12 yoke of oxen. Now, commentators take a guess. Is this 12 pairs of oxen, or is this 6 oxen, 12 total, in the pairings there? Doesn't matter which necessarily it was, but this is a pretty formidable team with which to plow. So he was probably a pretty prosperous individual. And he was with the 12th, in other words, in the back, guiding and plowing as they did. They walked behind and guided the plow into the soil. Then Elijah passed by him and threw his mantle on him. So Elijah, to show a clear delineation of what was going on, threw his cloak over Elisha. Now, did it cover him up or what? But no, he knew what was going on. Verse 20, he left the oxen and ran after Elijah. This was all very clear. It was clear what was going on. And said, please let me kiss my father and mother, then I will follow you. So, good thing to say goodbye to mom and dad. And that's what he did. So we assume that he was still a fairly young man at this point, very young man in this case. And he said to him, Elijah says to Elisha, go back again, for what have I done to you? In other words, you know what I've done to you. This is it. Say goodbye. You're not going to be plowing anymore. You have a new responsibility, a new job. So Elisha turned back from him, took a yoke of oxen and slaughtered them and boiled their flesh using the oxen's equipment. Talk about full commitment to the new responsibility. Gave up farming altogether. Gave it to the people and they ate. So they threw a celebration in essence. Then he arose and followed Elijah and became his servant. So God's people, again, must discern, just like Elisha did, just like the 50 sons of the prophets did, they must discern where God is working, and then with their whole heart, like Elisha does here, like the prophets did later on, they support that work to the best of their ability. They see what God is doing. They have that discernment through His Holy Spirit. Now, we pause for a moment just to note that Elisha became Elijah's servant. Do you by chance remember the name of Elisha's servant? You probably do. Gehazi, right? He comes to play a little bit later on. Will he be the same type of faithful servant that Elisha is to Elijah? Well, we'll see that as we go along. Let's go back to 2 Kings, this time to chapter 5, and we'll continue in the story flow that we left off last time of miracles, this string of miracles that God does through His servant, and apply them to how we might learn lessons today. 2 Kings chapter 5, beginning in verse 1. We'll simply label this point, God asks simple things. What can we learn from this miracle? God asks simple things. Now, we could say things like, well, God heals. Well, yeah, that's true also. Secondary lesson we might learn. But in this case, let's read through the story, the miracle, and then see how we relate it to God asking simple things. Now, Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great and honorable man in the eyes of his master. Wow. So here's this Syrian commander, this general, we might say, commander of the army, chief of staff over the army. Great and honorable man in the eyes of his master, because by him the Eternal had given victory to Syria. He was also a mighty man of valor, but a leper. Now, one of the things that is important to note is that some of this commander's fame and prestige came from his victories over Israel. God actually had used this man, this general of the Syrian army, to correct his own people. And nonetheless, he's called a mighty man of valor, but he was leprous. And having leprosy, this would simply separate him for the rest of his life. So this was a very grave concern. The Syrians, verse 2, had gone out on raids. Raids where? Raids into Israel. Again, God was allowing these raids to turn his people back to him. that they suffer these defeats, that all the edges of their territory is being eaten away by these raiders, and yet they refuse to turn back to God. But that was the purpose of these raids, and God allowed people like Naaman to command these raids and be successful to help his people repent. Syrians had gone out on raids and brought back a captive, a young girl from the land of Israel. And as was often the case, they would kill the men and they would bring back the women as slaves or servants. And she waited on Naaman's wife. So the general's wife's servant. I often wonder how this may have taken place in verse 3. Then she said to her mistress, now, when did this take place? Were they talking about leprosy? Was she brushing her hair before the wife went to bed? Or what was the story? She simply said, if only my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria, for he would heal him of his leprosy. Now, whether or not Elisha had healed, been used to heal leprosy previously, this young girl had recognized where God was working and recognized that nothing would be too hard for Elisha since God was backing him. And so she just spoke out loud about this, and the wife took great hope that this might be the case, that he could be healed from an incurable disease normally. So she tells her husband, husband tells the king, and the king says, yeah, let's see if we can work that out. He was beloved by his king. So verse 4, Naaman went in and told his master, saying, thus and thus said the girl who is from the land of Israel. Then the king of Syria said, go now, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel. So he departed and took with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing. This is a huge payment. This is going to be a gift to give to Israel in return for the healing of this leprosy. Verse 6, then he brought the letter to the king of Israel, which said, now be advised, when this letter comes to you, that I have sent Naaman, my servant, to you, that you may heal him of his leprosy. So imagine being the king and you get this letter. Oh, all you have to do is heal my servant of an incurable disease. So he panics. Verse 7, it happened when the king of Israel read the letter that he tore his clothes and said, am I God to kill and make alive, that this man sends me a man for me to heal him of his leprosy? Therefore, please consider and see how he seeks a quarrel with me. So the king thought it was all a setup, that he knows I can't heal this man. So he's going to come with his army and say, you refuse to heal my servant, so we're attacking you. He thought it was all a big setup. But verse 8, so it was when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, that he sent to the king, saying, why have you torn your clothes? Please let him come to me, and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel. In other words, a representative of the true God. So verse 9, then Naaman went with his horses and chariot, and he stood at the door of Elisha's house. Now, what was he expecting? Apparently, he was expecting some kind of witch doctor to come out there, cut himself, yell and scream, throw dust in the air, mix some potion, spray it on him, and then he'd be healed. He expected some kind of sideshow. And Elisha didn't even come out of the door. He sent a post-it note with his servant out the door with the formula on it. Elisha sent a messenger to him saying, go take a bath. I mean, that's at least the way Naaman looked at it. Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored to you, and you shall be clean. And that infuriated Naaman. Verse 11, Naaman became furious and went away and said, indeed, I said to myself, he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Eternal His God and wave his hand all over the place and heal the leprosy. So he expected some kind of sideshow. All he said was, go wash 7 times. Go dip yourself in the Jordan, come back out. Go in and wash yourself again, come out. And in and out, and in and out, and in and out, and in and out, seven times, and you'll be healed. God asked something very simple. And that's the lesson that we can take from Naaman. And yes, God heals, but God asks simple things of you and of me. He simply says, love each other. Simple. Simple request. He says that love is broken down into two categories, love toward God and love of fellow man. And then it's broken down into those Ten Commandments so we can better understand what it means to love God. How do we express love to God? How do we express love to our neighbor? Pretty simple. 10 simple commandments. God asks simple things. Now, sometimes it can be difficult because we're in the world that we are. But when we're told to honor our father and mother, that's a pretty simple thing. It doesn't say, well, make sure your parents are honorable before you honor them. No, we have to do that anyway. Remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. That's pretty simple. Not difficult to find out today when the Sabbath is. Plenty of information. Go to any dictionary or any encyclopedia or any online search engine and you'll find when the Sabbath is. Pretty simple to find out and when it is. All we have to do is keep it holy. Now that can be a challenge in Satan's world. But it's pretty simple things. God asks simple things. The road to the kingdom is not complex. It's simple. Sometimes it's hard to do. The road is narrow, but it is very simple. You don't have to memorize great swaths of Scripture to be in God's kingdom. You have to be obedient. We have to trust and obey, as the song says. So we are asked to pray. We are asked to study His Word. We're asked to meditate on that Word, to think deeply about it. We're asked to fast occasionally. We're told to observe the Holy Convocation, to be together with God's people on the Sabbath day. It's not just the Sabbath, by the way, that's holy. It's a holy convocation. That's what the Scripture says. So this meeting is holy and set apart by God. Now, we can log in and listen when we cannot be here, but it is not a substitute for the holy convocation, unless we're sick and cannot be here. God asks simple things. So He's told by His servants, after being mad and stomping off, verse 12, He says this, are not the Abana and the Pharphar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean? What, go take a bath? Is He serious? So He turned and went away in a rage. And His servants came near and spoke to Him and said, my father, if the prophet had told you to do something great, would you not have done it? If He told you to stand on your head for 3 hours, cut yourself, mix the blood with the wing of a bat and stir it over a hot fire and boil it and drink it, would you have done that? Well, yes, you would have, because you would have thought, whoa, this is really something. But take a bath? I mean, it's a pretty simple thing He's asking. Why don't you try it? How much more, I don't know where I got that formula, by the way. I just made that up. It's not in my notes. So don't try that. How much more then if He says to you, wash and be clean? Why don't you try it? It's pretty simple. What do you have to lose? So verse 14, He went down and dipped seven times in the Jordan according to the saying of the man of God, and His flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and He was clean. So not only was He healed of the leprosy, but now they called Him Babyface Naaman. We have a little grandson who's just turned a year old. And I know what baby flesh is like. This cute little fresh, happy baby stuff is just amazing. And that's what he was like. It wasn't old and wrinkled and crinkly. Wow, this was a stunning miracle. Naaman never looked so good than he did at this point. So verse 15, he returned to the man of God and all his aides and came and stood before him and said, indeed, now I know that there is no God in all the earth except in Israel. What he is saying is there's nobody like this God. Now, therefore, please take a gift from your servant. God asks simple things. And when we obey those simple things, he blesses us in spiritual ways, primarily in physical ways following that. All we have to do strive to follow God to the best of our ability. Now, we had mentioned, of course, this issue of a servant, and that comes to play here. Elijah in verse 16 says, "As the Eternal lives before whom I stand, I will receive nothing." And he urged him to take it, but he refused. So there's probably a couple reasons for that that we might assume. One is that you don't pay for God's miracles. It's not something you sell. And Elisha certainly didn't want to be known that, "Stop in, if you got the right price, we can get a miracle for you." This was not about Elisha. This was about acknowledging where the true God actually was. The true God was over Israel. Secondarily, he didn't want it out there that Elisha got to be wealthy off the payment of a Syrian general. So clearly he refused. This is not for sale. This is not something you sell. So, verse 17, Naaman said, "Then if not, please let your servant be given 2 mule loads of earth. For your servant will no longer offer either burnt offering or sacrifice to other gods, but to the Lord or to Yahweh." What was going on here? Well, a reminder, as you probably know, in that day and age, gods were considered territorial, that certain gods had authority over certain physical territory. So the God of Israel only had authority over the land of Israel. And if your God was able to conquer that land, that means your God was stronger than their God. So he realized that he needed some of Israel's territory to be able to worship the God of Israel. Now, he was obviously functioning on bad information, bad prejudices that he had gained as a child, that God is over this certain turf. So I need to take some of this turf with me so that I can worship God on his turf. So a couple mule loads of earth, pretty unusual request unless we understand it. So he said, "I'd like to sacrifice to this God." Now, did he have a grasp of the true God and all that God required? Well, no, but it might have been a start at least. Now, he says, with these mule loads of earth, he does offer one exception. "Yet," verse 18, "in this thing, may Yahweh pardon your servant." In other words, I'm only going to sacrifice to this God, but I'm in this position. This political situation where I work for the king and the king worships other gods, so he's going to expect me to go to church with him, is what basically he's saying. "When my master goes into the temple of Rimmon to worship there, and he leans on my hand, and I bow down in the temple of Rimmon, may the Eternal, may Yahweh, please pardon your servant in this thing. I'm going to be kneeling there with the king, but I don't really mean it." Okay, that's a compromise, obviously, but he wasn't going to condemn him. It's probably the best he could do at this point in his life. So verse 19, "Then he," Elisha, "says to him," Naaman, "go in peace." So he departed from him a short distance. So he set up camp a little bit down the road. Now, Elisha didn't say this was okay, but he simply said, "Go in peace." You're going to have to work that out along the way. Now, whether or not Naaman ever came any closer to the true God than this, we're not told. But nonetheless, he took off and went. Now, this next section is a miracle, but it's almost, in one sense, a miracle in reverse. And there is a lesson, certainly, we can learn from it. We talked about the servant, Elisha, serving Elijah so faithfully. Now we have Elisha's servant, Gehazi, not serving so faithfully. Verse 20, "But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God," pause for a second. Remember the situation with Elijah and Elisha? Elisha was specifically chosen to be the servant of Elijah to take the mantle of authority after Elijah passes from the scene. Is it possible? We're not told. But is it likely that Gehazi, mentioned by name, would have been the successor to Elisha after he departs from the scene? That's very likely. Unfortunately, Gehazi disqualifies himself. He says in the middle of verse 20, "Look, my master has spared Naaman, this Syrian, while not receiving from his hands what he brought. But as the Eternal lives, I will run after him and take something from him." Now, he could have justified himself possibly by saying, well, he should pay something for the benefit he's gotten. After all, he's a Syrian. The Syrians are our enemies. Why would he not take some payment from this pagan? Whatever was going on in Naaman's mind, the bottom line was that he was wrapped up with covetousness. And that is the lesson of Gehazi, is that, brethren, we cannot be wrapped up in covetousness. We must not be wrapped up in stuff, coveting. So, verse 21, Gehazi pursued Naaman. And when Naaman saw him running after him, he got down from the chariot to meet him and said, "Is all well?" And he said, "All is well. My master has sent me," truth or lie? Lie. "Saying, indeed, just now, two young men of the sons of the prophets have come to me from the mountains of Ephraim." Second lie. "Please give them a talent of silver and two changes of garments." Story seemed to match. You got two prophets coming out of the mountains and need two changes of clothes. So Naaman said, "Please take two talents." And of course, Gehazi said, "No, no, no, okay." He urged him and bound two talents of silver in two bags with two changes of garments and handed them to two of his servants, and they carried them on ahead of him. So this is no small weight of silver and clothing, because the two servants had to carry it. So Naaman's two servants come with Gehazi, verse 24, when they came to the citadel. In other words, this outer portion, kind of just before you'd go to the actual house where Elisha and Gehazi lived. "He took them from their hand and stored them away in the house. And then he let the men go and they departed." What was Gehazi's do? What was he doing? He was keeping Elisha out of sight line of these Syrians, assuming that Elisha would not be wise as to what was going on. Well, God revealed what had been happening. Verse 25, "Now he went in and stood before his master. Elisha said to him, 'Where did you go, Gehazi?' And he said, 'Your servant did not go anywhere.'" Another lie, lie after lie after lie. Kind of like a little child with chocolate chips around his lips and the cookie jar open. "Johnny, did you take a chocolate chip cookie?" You either say yes or no. Either tell the truth, fess up, repent, or continue to lie. In this case, he continued to lie. "Your servant did not go anywhere." "Then he said to him, 'Did mine heart not go with you when the man turned back from his chariot to meet you?'" In other words, in essence, what he's saying, "You broke my heart. He just broke my heart when you went running after this guy for stuff." "Is it," he says, a great quote, "is it time to receive money and to receive clothing and olive groves and vineyards and sheep and oxen, male and female servants?" In other words, is now the time for getting? And we ask ourselves the same question. Are we wrapped up in coveting where our entire existence is focusing on what are we getting next? Our stuff. Some people take this to the ridiculous extreme that they're going to defend their stuff. And they're going to take a 45 or a 38 and put it under their pillow. And if someone tries to take their stuff, they're going to put a 38 slug in their forehead. That's wrong. That's sinful. We need to learn what Gehazi needed to learn. If that's our approach and attitude, it's only stuff. Is now the time to grasp at simple physical things that are all going to be destroyed? That's not saying we don't wisely plan, wisely use what we have. But if it's all we're focusing on, that becomes our life. We've got to have these things. Then we fall into the same condemnation that Gehazi did. Is now the time for that stuff? Put our treasure, as Christ said, where our treasure is, there will our heart be also. So if our treasure is in the the kingdom of God. That's what we'll be focusing on. Verse 27, here's the miracle. Therefore, the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and your descendants forever. And he went out from his presence leprous, as white as snow. Sad event. Sad way to learn that covetousness brings penalties. Now, several have asked, when it says, leprosy shall cling to you and your descendants forever, is God saying that every descendant of Gehazi would have leprosy from that point forward? That's probably not what's being described. What he's simply saying is that you're going to have leprosy, and it's going to cling to you. That story, that shame, will cling to all of your descendants as well. To this day, when we hear the name Gehazi, we probably think about this leprosy that came upon him for his greed, for his covetousness. So it is, in that sense, sticking to the family from that time forward. Let's continue on. Another lesson that we might learn continues on in 2 Kings 6 here, beginning in verse 1. And that is, God has power over the environment. Let's see how that plays out. God has power over the environment. The sons of the prophets said to Elisha, "See now, the place where we dwell with you is too small for us." In this case, prophets, of course, as we know, could have wives. And when prophets have wives, wives of prophets have children. And as a result, they were outgrowing the facility they lived in. Remember the story we had looked at last time, where one of the widows of the prophet and her sons were basically going to be thrown into prison, into slavery. So wives of prophets have children, and they're probably outgrowing this facility. So please, verse 2, let us go to the Jordan and let every man take a beam from there and let us make there a place where we might dwell. So he answered, go, good idea. Let's expand the facility. Let's make sure we have enough space to live. They would go down to the Jordan because that's where trees grew next to the river, so they could harvest enough lumber to build what they needed. Verse 3, then one said, please consent to go with your servants. And he answered, I will go. Come with us. Oversee the project, we might say. Verse 4, so he went with them. And when they came to the Jordan, they cut down trees. That's what they were planning. But as one was cutting down a tree, the iron axe head fell into the water. This would have been quite an expensive piece of equipment at this time. Iron forges were rare, and this would have been a borrowed piece of equipment. He says, he cried out and said, Master, alas, Master, for it was borrowed. So this expensive piece of equipment that now would have to be paid for was distressing this individual, rightly so. So the man of God said, where did it fall? And he showed him the place. So he cut off a stick and threw it in there, and he made the iron float. That's impossible. What was it about this stick that caused the iron axe head to float? And of course, it was nothing about the stick at all. It was simply symbolic of kind of reuniting the axe handle with the axe head. And out pops this iron axe head. It's floating on the water. Now, if you see something like this floating on the water, maybe the individual felt that some sea monster was bringing it up to the surface. So you think, I'm going to put my hand in there? I don't think so. But verse 6, the man of God said, where did it fall? He makes the iron float. Verse 7, he said, pick it up for yourself. Get it. So he reached out his hand and took it. God has power over the environment. He can suspend the laws, quote unquote, of nature anytime he desires. It is not impossible for God to do anything. He created these laws. He is able to suspend them at will. He's able to create things that are not there at the moment. He's able to suspend law. He's able to heal in an impossible situation. God is able to do each of these things. Remember talking, fellowshipping one time many years ago with an individual. We were talking about this story. And they said, you know, I really thought about this miracle when I was in the rest stop in the rest room. And I was putting myself back together after using the restroom, and the remote for the car popped out of my pocket and into the toilet. And it was one of those automatic flush toilets that just, I stood up, it fell in a kaboom. And I prayed immediately about this story, and the axe head floats. God, you... Too late. So he said, I imagined in my mind that somewhere in the water treatment facility, there was this floating car remote. But I'm not sure I would even reach in and get it at that point. So thankfully, he had a spare and they could go on their way. But he said, I thought about this story at that time. The point is, brethren, it's not difficult for God to alter the physical environment. Many of us have seen God specifically do that kind of thing, where violent storms split in half and pass around where the people of God are meeting. People of God are protected in the midst of a terrible storm. The proverb, or I should say the psalm that says, 1,000 will fall at your right, 10,000 at your left. These things are true. God can alter the environment to make sure his people are cared for. Let's go on to another story. Two left. In 2 Kings chapter 8, beginning in verse, I'm sorry, 2 Kings 6, beginning in verse 8, continuing on here, we have another story. We might actually say there are two lessons we might learn from this. We'll identify them as we go along. But I would say there are two things to note as we go through this miracle. 2 Kings 6 in verse 8. Now the king of Syria was making war against Israel. Now, who was the commander of the army in Syria? Well, it was Naaman, the man who had been healed. And yet, God still allowed Syria to make war against Israel because Israelites were not worshiping the true God in honesty, and God was allowing them to be corrected. The king of Syria was making war against Israel. And he consulted with his servants, saying, my camp will be in such and such a place. So they're talking strategy in the war room. And the man of God sent to the king of Israel, saying, beware that you do not pass this place, for the Syrians are coming down there. So everything that the king plans is given supernaturally to Elisha, and he sends a note to the king of Israel. Verse 10, the king of Israel sent someone to the place of which the man of God had told him. Thus he warned him, and he was watchful there, not just once or twice. This happened over and over and over again. Verse 11, therefore, the heart of the king of Syria was greatly troubled by this thing. And he called his servants and said to them, will you not show me which of us is for the king of Israel? The only conclusion he could come to is that clearly we have a rat in here. We have got a mole. And this mole is sending information to Israel every time we have a meeting. And one of the servants said, no, Lord, none, my Lord, O king. But Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom. I mean, you can whisper this in your wife's ear in the middle of the night in complete privacy, and somehow Elisha gets the message. Something supernatural going on here. So, verse 13, he said, go and see where he is, that I may send and get him. In other words, send out spies, find out where this guy lives. I'm going to grab him and either kill him or bring him back here, and maybe he'll do the same things here. So he was told him, saying, surely he is in Dothan. Now, who do you suppose gave the king of Syria that information? Who was just at his house not too much longer before this? Well, maybe Naaman. They were not told, but maybe it was Naaman who said, well, I know where he lives. I've been there. He lives in Dothan. Therefore, he sent horses and chariots and a great army there. And they came by night and surrounded the city. And when the servant, the man of God, paused for a second. His servant, Elisha's servant, is no longer called by name. Because, remember we read back in chapter 5, the last verse says, Naaman, Gehazi was given this leprosy, and he went out from his presence. Gehazi was fired, and no longer would he be the servant of Elisha. So whomever this is, he's not named by name anymore. Verse 15, when the servant of the man of God arose early and went out, there was an army surrounding the city with horses and chariots. And his servant said to him, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" What do we learn from this? God will protect his people. So he answered, "Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." God will protect his people. Now the servant, of course, looks around and says, "I don't see more of us than them. There's a lot of horses out there, a lot of chariots, and we got virtually nothing in here." So Elisha prayed, verse 17, and said, "Eternal, I pray, open his eyes that he may see." Then the Eternal opened the eyes of the young man, again, not Gehazi, whatever his replacement was, whoever his replacement was. He opened the eyes of the young man and he saw. And behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. So maybe the same kinds of chariots and fire, horses, that had separated Elijah from Elisha when the time for changing hands took place. So we may not often see or recognize the fact that those who are with us are more than those who are with the enemy. God protects and watches over his people. We can take great comfort in that. So when the Syrians came down to him, Elisha prayed to the Eternal and said, "Strike this people, I pray, with blindness." So the second lesson we learn from this miracle is that God affects minds. God affects minds for the benefit of his people. Were these people blind? It says he struck them with blindness according to the word of Elisha. Could they not see? Oh no, they could still see, but they could not perceive accurately. So Elisha simply says to them in verse 19, "This is not the way. This is not where you want to be. Nor is this the city you want to be in. Follow me, and I'll bring you to the man whom you seek." Now, was all that true? Yeah. This is not the place. This is not, "Follow me, and I'll show you, Elisha." Well, that was Elijah there. But he wasn't going to tell them that yet. They were completely blinded. "Oh, great, we'll follow you." So he led them to Samaria. So what was fascinating is God affected the minds of these individuals to believe that they were going to find Elisha. So Elisha leads them directly into the national capital of Samaria, where the army would have very easily surrounded this band of soldiers and could have slaughtered them. Verse 20, "So it was when they had come to Samaria that Elisha said, 'Lord, open the eyes of these men that they may see.'" Well, they weren't blind in the sense they couldn't see, but they couldn't perceive. God can change and affect the mind of individuals for the benefit of his people. And we've seen those kinds of things before. You may have been the recipient of someone like this, where you had a boss that couldn't stand you or what you stood for. And we pray about that, and we ask God to intervene, and he either removes that person, or all of a sudden there's something that completely changes their mind. I told you the story before about how in high school God displayed this very clearly to me. A band director who hated my guts because I started keeping the Sabbath. Wouldn't play in the marching band on Friday nights in high school. And all of a sudden I became the focus of his ire. Interesting, though, we prayed about that, asked God to continue to step in, endured the issues that came along with that until one day no one else could be at a particular event and I could be, and all of a sudden everything changed. And all of a sudden this person now realized that he was completely wrong. I just wasn't It wasn't by chance. God intervened in his mind. So he said, open their eyes that they may see. And the Lord opened their eyes and they saw that they were inside Samaria, surrounded by Israel's army. Now when the king of Israel saw them, he said to Elisha, my father, shall I kill? Shall I kill? But he answered, you shall not kill. Would you kill those whom you've taken captive with your sword and your bow? No, that's not the right way to do it. Kindness is the thing to do. Set food and water before them that they may eat and drink and go to their master. Elisha had insight that the king of Israel did not have. He would have slaughtered them on the spot. And of course, what response would that have brought? Well, you kill my soldiers, we'll send a bigger army and we'll kill your soldiers. Instead, he said, treat them kindly. Send them back to their master. Far more important things will take place as a result. So, verse 23, he prepared a great feast for them. And after they ate and drank, he sent them away and they went to their master. We see a New Testament principle there, don't we? Be kind to those who spitefully use you. It's like pouring coals of fire. It's going to work on their minds. Pour coals of fire on their head. It's going to work on their mind. How can someone I've treated so badly still be so kind? So they went to their master. The bands of Syrian raiders came no more into the land of Israel. So God affected not only the minds of these soldiers to blind them and follow Elisha right into what could have been a terrible trap. He also affected the mind of the king of Syria to stop sending raiding parties into Israel during this time. Kindness paid off, had the desired effect. Let's go on to one final lesson before we close. And that is, God honors his servants. God honors his servants. This final miracle that we'll take a look at actually took place after Elisha died. After Elisha died. Yet God is showing honor to his servants even at that time. Turn to 2 Kings chapter 13. 2 Kings 13. And we'll read in verse 14. 2 Kings 13 and verse 14. It says, Elisha had become sick with the illness of which he would die. Indication seems to be that God decided it was now time for Elisha to die. In the same way, he decided that it was time for Elijah to retire, to be removed from the scene. Now is the time for Elisha to die. God had this well under control. Then Joash, the king of Israel, came down to him and wept over his face and said, oh, my father, the chariots of Israel and their horsemen. This may have become a colloquial phrase now in Israel after Elijah disappeared with this same chariot and horsemen. It might be a euphemism for death at this point. In other words, he looked at him in essence is saying, you're circling the drain, Elisha. In other words, now is the time. I see what's happening here. He wept over him. He was so sorry to see him so ill. But he knew by looking at him, it was time. So Elijah, of course, tells him to take the bow and arrow. And you remember the story there. He shoots arrows out. And unfortunately, the king of Israel stopped at three instead of kept going and kept going and kept going. But Syria now is only going to be held off three times and then they would conquer. But then verse 20, Elisha died. And they buried him. So he was placed inside of his tomb. And the raiding bands from Moab invaded the land in the spring of the year. So we're not told exactly how much time had elapsed since Elisha was buried and this spring of the year, but it must have been at least some time. Verse 21, so it was, as they were burying a man, that suddenly they spied a band of raiders and they put the man in the tomb of Elisha. They had to hide and hide quickly. So they threw the dead guy on top of Elisha's bones. And when the man was let down and touched some of the bones of Elisha, he revived and stood on his feet. So talk about a spectacular miracle, a resurrection to more physical life. He wasn't given a spirit body at this point. He just woke up from death and was revived. So even after his death, God was showing where his servants were, honoring not just the memory of Elisha, but probably drawing attention to what Elisha taught. And that was certainly the more important thing. Why were these Moabite raiders having success? Because of Israel's sin. So God, in one sense, is reminding Israel where to turn. Turn to the God of Elisha. Follow what Elisha said, and you'll be fine. So this man stood on his feet, a tremendous testimony to the Spirit of God that was present in Elisha. Now, if we were to find Elisha's bones today, would they resurrect people? The answer is no. This was an event to show where God was working, to show Israel where they needed to turn after they went through the troubles that they were going through. So tremendous testimony that God honors his servants and their teachings even after they die. Well, brethren, God used Elisha to perform many great miracles. And while we enjoy the stories of God's intervention in these stories, in these ways, let's be sure that we're not just enjoying the stories, but applying the lessons that we all might learn from the miracles God did through Elisha.